Yeah. Then people complain that the air conditioners are, you know, going too strong, and either they have to freeze or I have to sweat. But this way, no one can complain. It's like I'm not in charge of the breeze. Mark chapter 5. And we'll drop in at verse 21. When Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him. And so he stayed by the seashore. One of the synagogue officials, named Jairus, came up and on seeing him fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she will get well and live." And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him and pressing in on him. A woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse, after hearing about Jesus, she came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. For she thought, "If I just touch his garments, I will get well." Immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And they're like, "Get over it, Lord." You can hear that in their voice, can't you? It's like, you know, we're all getting jostled here. Just, you know, put up with it. And he looked around to see the woman who had done this. But the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Okay, here's what I want to do with this story is I want to go through it once and notice the sort of things we would typically see in a Bible study. And then I want to go back to it and focus on what we'd probably overlook typically. And I'll make a big deal out of that. That's where I'll introduce my heresy and then we'll be done. But Mark does a masterful job. Oh, good. Great. Perfect. Mark does a masterful job of rushing us through her biography. He gives us her history in short, clipped phases that are strung together by the word "and." Verse 24, "And he went off with him, and a large crowd was following him, and pressing on him. A woman who had," and here's her biography, "a woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians." Same word in the Greek, "much" and "many." So she's been through a lot. "And had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse." Okay, so this gives us some appreciation for what she suffered and what drives her to Jesus on this particular day. And Mark then is introducing to us a character in the story who has lived on the margins. She's on the margin of the story. If you contrast her with Jairus, Jairus is a synagogue official. He has status. Well, first of all, he's male in a society that favors males. He has status. She has none. She has negative status. He has honor. She has shame. And so she moves on the periphery of the story. She's also on the margin of society, being female, but especially being labeled unclean. And she's unclean because of this hemorrhaging, which according to the Old Testament law disqualified her from going anywhere near God's dwelling place, but even disqualified her from having physical contact with other people. So the marginalized person does not belong to society. That's why they're marginalized. They're pushed to the periphery of society, and they're allowed to exist there, but they're not allowed to engage. They're excluded from normal activity. In her case, from the normal activity of the town or the neighborhood, even normal activities of her families. She couldn't go to weddings and that sort of thing. They don't enjoy full rights and privileges like everyone else, and they're excluded from certain places. And so here she is on the margin, and Mark introduces us to this marginalized character. But as we watch, she sneaks from the margin to the center. And Jesus is obviously the center. Everyone's there to hear him, to see him. They're crowding around him. And she comes up to the center from the margin. But even when she gets to the center, she's only on the margin of the center, because she comes behind Jesus, and Matthew says that she touched just the fringe of his robe, and that particular word is his outer garment, so his overcoat, and she only touches the fringe of it. So from the margin of society to the margin, to some kind of marginal contact with Jesus, the kind of person who wants to be invisible, and most of society wants them to be invisible. We don't want to have to be bothered with these poor and fortunate people, because then might feel like we should do something for them. We want them to be invisible. She wants to be, and then she's ready to go. She did not want a face to face with Jesus. Now Jairus obviously did, and he could do that. He had the status to do that. She did not want a face-to-face. She did not want to become a disciple. I mean, as far as we can tell from the story, she's not even interested in his teaching. Who is Jesus? I don't know. What does he have to say? I don't know. I don't care. I've only heard about him, that he can help people like me, people as desperate as I am, as gone as I am, that he can help. And that's all I want. So I don't want to bother him. I don't want to engage with him. I don't want to come out publicly and ask him for anything. I don't want anyone to even know that I'm here. The crowd's a perfect cover for a person like me. I can get in there, get what I want, and leave. He doesn't even have to know me or know that I was there. She only sneaked up behind him to steal a touch, to steal a healing, and then melt into the crowd and make her getaway. So she comes as a thief. But before she could get behind the protection of the wall of people, Jesus had spun around and demanded to know, who touched me? Literally, who touched me on my clothing? For though she only touched the fringe of his overcoat, he felt her touch his heart. And he did not allow her to come and steal what he was willing to freely give. He did not allow her to go away with just a touch. Now, I am going to suggest, and I'm not sure that I can prove it, though I think there are indications in the text, I'm going to suggest that if she had gone away like she had planned, and he had not said, who touched me, she would have gone away healed, but not whole. Because Jesus tells her in verse 34, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction. She was healed of her affliction when she touched him. And that particular Greek word refers to health. But the other word refers to wholeness. In fact, it is the New Testament word for salvation. Your faith has saved you. Your faith has made you whole. So it's possible that if he had allowed her to go away, she would have gone away healed but not whole. She still would have been a broken person. So it may not be obvious at first, but the same reason why Jesus stopped and said, who touched me, is why he refused to give a sign to the Pharisees when they said, show us a sign from heaven that, you know, to authenticate who you are. Jesus was not willing to commit himself to just anyone. Show us a sign, wonder worker. Well, if I do, what will you do? What are you willing to put into this? Are you ready to set everything aside for me? Are you ready to embrace me as Lord of the universe if I show you this sign? Or will it just be for your entertainment? Or will it just give you some other thing to argue against, to argue down? In John's Gospel, it says, now, when he was in Jerusalem at Passover, during the feast, many believed in his name, observing his signs which he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, was not entrusting himself to them. For he knew all men, and because he did not need anyone to testify concerning men, for he himself knew what was in man. They were believing in him. He wasn't believing in them. He wasn't believing that they were at that point where they were ready to receive him on his terms or deal with him on his terms. People come to God and in essence they're praying, God, give me a pill that will fix me. Now, I don't want to stop being me. I don't want to give up anything. I don't want to change anything. I just want you to repair me so I can go back to the life I was living. I mean, do we understand that? Do we get that? Just let me have my healing. That's all I'm asking, so I can turn to life as normal. And Jesus doesn't do it. God doesn't comply. And, you know, then we get frustrated and upset with him. But listen, I have seen instances where a friend of mine was told, you're not going to get this heart transplant unless you stop smoking. And another friend was told, you're not going to get this liver transplant unless you stop drinking. And then I had a friend who was told, you're not eligible for a liver transplant because you've been heavy drinking within the last 6 months. And he didn't want to give it up anyway, so he chose death over transplant. And that was just a year ago. So the surgeon says, there are certain conditions, certain permanent changes in your life you're going to have to make if you want this heart, or if you want this liver. Are they being unfair, or are they being unreasonable in their demands? You've got to break this habit or this dependency if you want this organ transplant. But I mean, think about it. Someone had to die for this patient to get a second chance at life. So is it right to accept that second chance and then waste it? And go back to the same behaviors that brought them to this point before. And there's something about this woman's touch that when she touched Jesus, she also touched the cross in the same way. Someone's going to have to die for her to get her healing, for her to get her wholeness. So is Jesus not going to make any demands on her? Is he going to say, yeah, I'm here to dispense whatever it is you need, just touch me and take it? Or is he going to stop her and say, wait a minute, you can't just walk away with this healing and not change some things, not give up some things, not be transformed. I'm not fixing you just to go back to what you were before. If someone is willing to put all their faith in Jesus, then he's ready to work with them. And so that's what he draws out, is her faith. So Jesus didn't let her disappear into the crowd. He didn't let her get away without facing him. He didn't let her return to the margin with her gift, but still broken. And he said, and so he makes her come forward, and She's afraid. She falls down in front of him and she tells the whole truth. I think that's great. Okay, you know, it's like once she starts talking, she can't stop. It's just like everything comes out. All the doctors, the disease, the uncleanness, everything comes out. All the stuff she didn't want anyone to know. And he says, "Daughter." I don't think he had to say anything more than that. I'm glad he did. I think the other stuff he said, "For our sakes, your faith has made you whole, and you're healed of your affliction." But when he said to her, "Daughter," he accomplished what it was that he wanted when he stopped and said, "Who touched me?" She only wanted a healing. He wanted a relationship. Why he chose daughter rather than sister, I don't know. But this is what he does, is he establishes a connection, a bond between himself and her, more than the informal bond of woman. Some women he addresses, woman, even his own mother, "Woman, what have I to do with you?" But this is daughter. And in this way, he gave her a more complete healing. Now she's able to be whole. She's no longer alone on the margin of society, but she now has a father and a brother in Jesus. And she walks with him. So that's the sort of lesson that we typically look for when we come to a story like this in Scripture. But there's another detail in the story, and it doesn't even seem important enough to point out, which is why I like it probably. And I'm afraid if I don't point it out, we're going to miss something useful and something a little bit alien to us. This story, if you look at it closely, hinges on consciousness or awareness. Both the woman and Jesus have their moment of awareness. There would be no story if the woman was not aware of the healing that took place in her body the moment that it happened. In fact, notice that these two verses both begin immediately. Verse 29, "Immediately the flow of her blood was dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed." There would be no story if Jesus was not aware of her touch. Verse 30, "Immediately Jesus perceived in himself that power had gone from him." Apart from these two moments of awareness, woman being aware of something happening in her body, Jesus being aware of something happening within his body, without that awareness, there's no story. And look at the language Mark uses. She felt in her body that she was healed. Perceiving in himself, power from him had gone forth. Fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, she knelt down before him. They both had a body consciousness which is really rare for us. We live at a distance from our body. It's a heritage of Greek culture from the time of Plato. So when we get to industrial society, the value of the body is its function in a factory. The same thing of socialistic society. The body becomes a functionary of the state. In consumer culture, the value of the body is its sales potential. Advertisers use the body, the physical human body, to sell products. And individuals use it to sell themselves. I want to make sure I dress right, make an impression when I go for this job interview. I want to make sure that I look sexy if I go out trolling at the bars or whatever. And the result is that our body awareness tends to be purely superficial. It's just, you know, it's just the externals. It's cosmetic. We are overly concerned and conscious of our body's appearance. We are not conscious or concerned enough with our body's experience of life. Antonio Damasio is the head of the Department of Neurology at the University of Iowa, and he's written a couple of books on neuroscience. One is entitled The Feeling of What Happens, or something like that. And he says emotions and feelings are tangibly about the body. This is, you know, the result of years and years of cutting monkeys to pieces. But emotions and feelings are tangibly about the body. And it's likely that prior to Greek influence, Damasio says, people were able to sense more about themselves than many of us are able to sense these days. The body communicates with the brain constantly, both its experience of things external to it, but also its internal state. And as a result, the brain makes adjustments, adjusting to the temperature, constantly keeping the body balanced. Proprioception, is that what that is?
Balance?
Yeah. Proprioceptions?
No. Homeostasis?
Oh, no, I'm talking about physical balance, like staying on your feet.
Oh, proprioception.
Yeah. That's what he said. We'll discuss this at home. Oh, yes, you will. It's not a war, it's a battle. And even if you win this, doesn't mean you win the war. Okay, so... Confession, I lost before I even stepped into that one. Okay, most of what the body and brain do in terms of keeping us balanced and adjusted, and homeostasis as well as proprioception or interoception or whatever, it goes on unconsciously. We don't even know that the brain is making all these calculations in physics when we take a step, especially if we're navigating uneven terrain or going upstairs or downstairs or stepping onto an escalator. The first time a person does that, watch how they concentrate. And generally what happens is you're too conscious of what you're doing and you mess up. Whereas if you let the brain just look at it and step into it, you're going to be okay. But we think we have to get in there and help. Emotions and feelings, according to Damasio, are physical states. See, emotion doesn't exist in this ethereal mental category. You know, and I think that sometimes we do that with emotions. We don't think of them as reality, like physical reality. We think of them as something that is more or less unreal and controllable, because we've discovered before that we could control our emotions to some degree. And what we don't understand is how physical emotions are, and how to even have emotions requires a communicative loop between the brain and the body, and that emotions require the nervous system to be intact in order to experience them, and that there are people who have suffered damage to their body or to their brain that leaves them incapable of normal emotional responses. There was a time in South America, one particular clinic, where they practiced a form of lobotomizing. It wasn't called lobotomizing, though, because it wasn't a lobotomy, but of surgically altering or creating lesions in the brain for people who were in severe pain. And Jeffrey Schwartz, who's a neuroscience researcher at UCLA, reported observing one of these patients prior to his surgery, that he was balled up on his bed in extreme pain. He had a strange ailment in which one portion of his face was highly sensitized, and even the lightest touch, even a breeze blowing across his cheek, would cause him excruciating pain. And so he was just balled up on his bed, trying not to let anything get near his face, but he was in agony. And he could not be coaxed to move out of that position because it was too painful. Schwartz visited again a couple days after his surgery, and he was with other patients playing cards, laughing, having a good time, apparently no problem whatsoever. And Dr. Schwartz asked him, well then, you have no more pain? And he said, oh no, the pain's still there. The pain's still there. It just doesn't bother me anymore. And what they had, the lesion they had caused in his brain, caused him not to experience emotion. So he could feel the pain without suffering. The suffering was the emotional part. In order to suffer from pain, in order to interpret anything as causing you suffering, you have to have your body and your brain working together. And we understand a whole lot more about how physiologically located our emotions are. So as I read this stuff, for instance, Damasio says, all emotions use the body as their theater. When you get nervous, have you ever noticed that your throat tightens up? I found that out in the fifth grade. I was trying out for a glee club. It wasn't the Madrigals, I remember that. It was glee club. My throat tightened up, and I squeaked, you know. And they said, "Thank you for coming in. Go back and play tetherball or something. You know, you're not called to music." And I thought, "This is so unfair." You know, my throat like turned against me just when I needed it. If you're sensitive enough to your body, you can feel in your body where emotions are occurring. And as I read this stuff, I thought, wow, none of this would be news to people living in Old Testament times. I mean, listen to this. The emotional experience of their lives was located in their bodies. In Psalm 38, there's just a great example of this. Oh Lord, rebuke me not in your wrath and chasten me not in your burning anger. For your arrows have sunk deep into me, and your hand has pressed down on me. Feeling of internal attack and external oppression. There's no soundness in my flesh because of your indignation. There's no health in my bones because of my sin. Or maybe because he's stressed out over his sin, his body's producing too much cortisol and it's actually starting to eat away at his bones. For my iniquities are gone over my head. As a heavy burden, they weigh too much for me. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my folly. I am bent over and greatly bowed down. I go mourning all day long, for my loins are filled with burning and there's no soundness in my flesh. I am benumbed and badly crushed. I groan because of the agitation of my heart. Lord, all my desire is before you, and my sign is not hidden from you. My heart throbs, my strength fails me, and the light of my eyes, even that has gone from me. You read through the Old Testament, Job, Psalms, Proverbs especially, and you find that people's bones could shake, and Job 4:14, that their bones could be vexed in Psalm 6:2. I won't give you the references. I'll put them in my notes on online.
Yeah, well. No, I'm teasing.
Yeah. No, I have no comeback. The flesh can experience security in God. It can also yearn for God. The heart can be glad, but it can also faint. The bowels can mourn and can agonize. Jeremiah. Father Romuald was explaining something about the bowels just this Friday night in our video. He said, in their anthropology, that is, those people of the Old Testament, in their anthropology, that's the deepest way you could feel. They're trying to express life's deepest feelings, and so they go to that deepest place in them. They didn't have any concept of the brain thinking thoughts. All the important stuff happened viscerally somewhere in the abdomen, you know, and, you know, from the neck to the loins. In fact, the Hebrew word nephesh, that's translated soul, literally means throat. And it was probably the passage of air through the throat that gave rise to the idea of soul. That's why it's sometimes used in parallel to ruach, which is spirit, and also translated wind or breath. Also, you look to the Old Testament, the eyes, the ears, the mouth, the lips, the tongue, the hands, the feet, the liver. Emotion is internal and visceral, and all of this now has the backing of medical science. We know what stress does to the body, to the circulatory system, to respiration, and how the body can affect the mind and emotions. So something is going on within the body that deserves attention, but we miss all of that. Why? Well, first of all, because we're constantly judging our bodies. Body, you know, you're not tall enough. Why weren't you taller? You don't have the right shape. You don't have the right contours. You're not as athletic as you used to be. You let me down. Second, we constantly silence or ignore our bodies. We learn to do this growing up. There's something about children. When they have a tummy ache, oh, I'm dying, my tummy. Oh, I'm dying. It's terrible. So you think you're having appendicitis or something. And then they pass gas. They go, oh, I'm fine now. And they think, oh, you know, I almost took them to the emergency room for trapped gas. I mean, you know, not only how embarrassing, but how costly. What's the price of trapped gas? But when they talk about things, when they talk about emotional things, if you say, you know, we're going to Disneyland, it's not, we're going to Disneyland? You know, the subdued excitement. It's, we're going to Disneyland, and they dance and they sing. It's like, they live out these, they know what their body is telling them. They hear it. And we learn to suppress that, you know, until we get really old and we stub our toe and it's like, oh, of course. You know, we just go on. We don't listen to the pain. And I'm not saying every time we stub our toe we have to dance around holding it and screaming, you know, profanities or anything like that. Our own adult songs of emotion. But in not paying attention to it, we silence its voice. And third, some of us judge our feelings. We judge our emotions. Oh, I shouldn't feel this way. I hate it when people say that. However you feel is however you feel. And whether it's appropriate to circumstances or not, it's how you perceive the circumstances. And rather than judge your feeling, just bring awareness to it. I'm feeling intense anger, the kind of anger that if I had a laser gun right now, I'd zap the car in front of me. Because that's what I feel like doing. Is this appropriate? Well, rather than judge that, just be with the anger. Just sit with it. And then wisdom will come, whether it's appropriate or not. Wisdom follows that kind of awareness. But it's a matter of learning to listen to our bodies. Sometimes we judge aches and pains. Now, I say we, and I should say I, but I'm using the royal plural here. You know, like the Queen of England, we judge our pains. And like I can wake up in the morning and my back aches and I begin to judge myself as a bad person for that and think I really should end my life. And now that seems like a hyper jump to you, but it makes perfect sense to me under the circumstances because of what goes on in my mind. The pain, what does the pain say? The pain says, you should have purchased a different mattress a long time ago. And if you weren't such a loser, you would have had the money for a good mattress. And the fact that you're in pain right now is because you're such a loser. And,
you're not a loser.
Well, where are you when I get up in the morning? You're in your own self-judging thoughts. I should be getting up too, you're thinking. So,
we pass the plate now?
Yes. Pass the mattress plate. You know what? It's not many. It's laziness. We're on the mattress when we should be up and out and doing other things, purchasing a new one. But the point is that I sometimes judge myself even for what's going on in my body. When it's nothing but physical and it has no moral value. It's not evidence that I'm worthless or whatever. Paul made a kind of ultimate statement about worship in Romans 12. He said, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. So what does that mean? Well, if I'm going to present my body to God, I better get it in shape, right? I should live healthier if I'm going to present my body to God. I need to clean all the inner negativity out of my body if I'm going to present it to God. And Paul doesn't say any of that. Present your body to God exactly as you are. Exactly as it is. Not by trying to dress it up first. Not by trying to fix it first. Bring it to God as it is. I mean, what hope would that woman have had if she had to stop the hemorrhage before she could go to Jesus for healing? Because it doesn't work that way. It's backwards. So there's nothing, we don't have to perfect ourselves. We don't have to come to God in a decent moral state. We don't have to come to God even with the best intentions. We can sneak up to Him trying to steal something from Him. But the important thing is that we come to God. The important thing is that we present ourselves to Him exactly as we are. So with whatever feelings you have, whatever emotions you have, whatever pain you have, present it to God. Your body will tell you the truth about yourself. Your body will tell you you're nervous. One time I walked into my psychiatrist's office. This is years ago when I needed one. obviously, from all I've said today, you know I no longer need one. But I walked into my psychiatrist's office and I sat down and he said, "You're nervous." Well, I never thought of myself as nervous before in all my life. I didn't think of myself as nervous right then. My mom is nervous. I was, you know, comparatively almost asleep. And he said, "You're nervous." I said, "Why do you say that?" He says, "Well, you're kind of fidgety and you're wringing your hands." And I noticed I'm wringing my hands. My body was giving me away. Your body will tell you the truth about yourself. You're uptight. You're sad. You're lonely. If we listen to our body. And I think we need to listen to our body when we come to God so we can come to Him in truth. And not with masks of greater righteousness than what we are. You don't have to come to God like that. He's the one you don't have to. And He is the one who knows. The psalmist presented all of these things to God. Despair, depression, feelings of abandonment, anger at God. "How long, O Lord, are you going to desert me?" they asked. You come to God, but you take a moment to be in your body and to see what's going on within. And you can do this by starting with the top of your head and slowly working your way down and just asking, what's here? What am I feeling here? What's the experience of my right hand right now? What's the experience of my knees right now? And maybe there's nothing there, so you just wait for a moment and then you move on. But someplace you're going to locate something that's worth presenting to God. An awareness is going to come to you that's worth bringing to His attention. Listen to what your body is telling you, both internally and externally. And what you discover as you're paying attention to your body is that your awareness enlarges until it goes out beyond your body to the presence of God right there with you. And then you can tune in to what Jesus is doing in you. Father, thank you for these stories of Scripture. Thank you for the big picture, which we sometimes miss because we don't know to put all the pieces together. But here's this woman aware of what's going on in her body, coming to Jesus and touching Him, and Him aware of what's going on in His body, and knowing that touch, even though she didn't touch His skin. But just this awareness of these internal factors, and help us not to continue to live as if we are distanced from our bodies, as if we're cut off from them. And all you want is some kind of spiritual existence from us that transcends the body. Teach us the spirituality that enjoys the pleasure of smelling the fragrance of a gardenia, that knows the challenge of panting up a steep hillside, that embodies the life of God when we touch a needy person. Help us to realize that we don't live so far from the kingdom of God after all, that in ways it is embodied within us, and we embody it whenever we say your name. Through Jesus. Amen.